Jay from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out over Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
How you doing, Darren?
I'm doing all right, John. How you been? How's life? How's your world? How's your health? Mental, physical? What are you all about today, John?
Pass.
All right. You
know, well, it's a never-ending hellscape. RGB died.
Oof. Yeah, that was a tough one.
Just when you think things can get, couldn't get more up in the air and frightening and stuff, the world finds a way to make it more so. So I'm glad we have outlets like this.
Life finds a way.
It does. It does, Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. It does.
Oh, man alive. I'm glad you get the references, my friend. Well done.
Yeah, you tie those two seatbelts together and you make it happen.
Indeed. I'm not sure if I missed that reference, but I'll play along like I did.
Okay, well, I'll let me go on a quick Jurassic Park tangent. I mean, it's not often that we go on a tangent 2 minutes into the podcast, but I'll just explain my joke real fast. Early in Jurassic Park, when they're flying into the island, Sam Neill's character is having trouble with his seatbelt. He has like the two female ends of the seatbelt, and so he can't get it to work. So what he does is he improvises and he ties the two ends of the seatbelt together. So life found a way. And also, like, that parallels what they do with the DNA, the dinosaur DNA, because, like, they breed all females, but the dinosaurs still find a way. So it's a little seatbelt foreshadowing in that movie.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen Jurassic Park in a minute, but, like, I mean, I remember when it came out, it was, like, a huge deal, but, like...
Yeah. I saw it in the theaters again when they re-released it for, I guess it was its 25th anniversary? It doesn't feel like that long ago that I saw it, but it was like the first time I'd seen it in the theater since 1993. And I'd remembered it as being like, all right, perfectly entertaining, but I wasn't ultra, ultra into it because I was never a huge dinosaur guy, but I really enjoyed it when I rewatched it. I was like, wow, this is a really good Spielberg movie, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of his best. It's one of the biggest ones he was like, he'll be remembered for.
Yeah. So I was very pleasantly surprised. It exceeded my expectations. I was just thinking like, oh, it'll be good. And, it's a nice spectacle movie, so it'll be fun to see on the big screen. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really, really good. So anyway.
Yeah. Guys, that's our review of Jurassic Park, guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast.
That's our little capsule review of Jurassic Park. Thank you. That's a little bonus content, a little bonus SNL Nerds content. But that, oddly enough, not the movie we're here to talk about today.
What?
Today, we are here to talk about 1980s How to Beat the High Cost of Living, which it's a bit of a shift for us on this podcast, because last week we did Office Space, which is a movie about three friends getting together to steal money. And this week we're doing How to Beat the High Cost of Living, which is a movie about three friends getting together to steal some money.
But these are all women, so totally different.
Exactly. And they did it first. So, yeah, I mean, exactly. To be fair, they beat Office Space to the punch by more than a decade. So
numbers don't lie. But actually, before we talk about the movie, we should talk about the latest SNL news that came in.
Yeah. Big week for SNL news. Let's get into this.
SNL news. Do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
SNL with Darren Patterson and John Trumbull. Good evening, folks, and what can I tell you?
Hi, cha-cha. So, yeah, I mean, we did some speculation about how SNL was going to come back, because I think they'd announced a return date, and we kind of speculated a little like, well, how are they going to do that? Are they going to do it in the studio? How do you do the social distancing? How do you have an audience at all? Do you have a limited audience? What do you do?
What do you do? And as it turns out, they will have an audience. It'll be a limited audience. So, you know, not too many people, and I'm assuming it'll be like socially distant, but it's going to be an audience, and also the entire cast is coming back, which I mean, I guess that's not a huge surprise, but it's still kind of surprising a little bit.
I mean, I feel good that I made some fairly accurate predictions. I predicted that everybody would come back because, if for no other reason, you want a for real goodbye show.
Right.
I predicted they would probably do a limited audience. As I recall, this is what I said. I don't listen to myself. I find myself annoying.
They also did an interview with Lorne Michaels about it. And Lorne Michaels said, according to Deadline, "We need the audience, obviously. With comedy, when you don't hear the response, it's just different. With the kind of comedy we do, which quite often is broad, timing gets thrown off without an audience. And for me, what is most important is when you're absolutely certain of some piece on Wednesday, and then the dress rehearsal audience sees it on Saturday and tells you you're wrong. I think us coming back and accomplishing the show will lead to, I hate to use the word normalcy, but it's a thing that is part of our lives coming back in whatever form it ends up coming back."
Mm-hmm.
So the mighty Lorne has spoken.
Lorne has spoken.
thunder, lightning.
Yeah. Frank, if you could put in some like thunder and lightning in that, you know, that could be a new thing for whenever Lorne Michaels releases a statement. We just put booming thunder behind it.
Right. And have our voice echo like we're in a cave.
Yeah, exactly.
Wrath of God stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And the show also, they announced that they're going to have three new featured players. They've got Lauren Holt, who Lauren says auditioned a year ago and then again last season. And he says the plan was to bring her in towards the end of the season that ended abruptly. She's funny and fresh. That's what Lauren says. And the next person is Punky Johnson, who is from New Orleans and a stand-up. And Andrew.
Great name.
Yeah, it's a cool name. And Andrew Dismukes, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that properly. I hope I'm getting that right. He was on the writing staff, but he's a stand-up as well. So.
I mean, the only person I was kind of familiar with is Punky. I know she's a stand-up from L.A. You know, like you said, she grew up in New Orleans, but like she kind of made her bones in the L.A. comedy scene at the, you know, Comedy Store and whatnot. And mm-hmm. I remember seeing her. There was a show on Comedy Central like a year ago, I believe, called The Ringers. It was like hosted by Bill Burr. I think he probably produced it as well. And like it's supposed to be a show where Bill Burr is like, "Hey, this show about all these stand-up comedians that you may not know, but you should know because they're really amazing." So Punky was on that show, and that's where I saw her. I was like, "Oh, she's really funny."
Well, cool. I mean, it's always fun to look forward to what the new people are going to bring. And we should mention, I don't think we've mentioned on the podcast before, they've announced that Ego Nuotam has been bumped up to a regular cast member.
Yay! Big things happening. Yeah, congrats. Yeah. And congrats, Ego.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some other SNL news. The show has won a few Emmys.
It has. We're recording this on Sunday, so the big Emmy show is tonight. But for the past few days, they've been, you know, doling out the, you know, creative Emmys. I guess the Emmys that don't get the big limelight, as it were.
Yeah, the Emmys that they give to the unattractive people.
Yes, the Uggos, as they I believe they call them.
But that's not entirely true, because like one of the Emmys was also for guest starring roles, and Maya Rudolph won a couple of those.
Yes, Maya Rudolph won for the her guest hosting when she was Kamala Harris.
Okay,
which is a big deal. Like I think she won for that, and she won for her performance on the animated show Big Mouth.
Yeah. Okay. Which I haven't seen. It's been recommended to me. I put it on my Netflix queue, and that's as far as it's gone.
All right.
Yeah.
Rave review.
I will watch it sometime after Cobra Kai.
Cobra Kai is Cobra Kai is pretty good. I'll give it that. That's a quick watch too. It's like they're all half hour episodes, and like the acting isn't great, but like the karate is pretty solid, and you know, it's just a lot of 80s, you know, hair rock. So that's thumbs up from me for that.
Okay. All right.
It's also won an Emmy. We got the great Eddie Murphy, won for outstanding guest actor when he hosted SNL back in this past December.
Yeah, that's well deserved. Not too surprising though.
Yeah, yeah. They also SNL also won outstanding variety sketch series this year.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Outstanding production design for variety, reality, or competition series. And outstanding directing, the great Don Roy King won an Emmy, and outstanding lighting design, lighting direction for a variety series.
That's really cool. It's a really good year for SNL, it sounds like.
They are sweeping up.
And, you know, and well-deserved, because, like, we probably don't say it often enough, but, like, the technical people at SNL, they are really, really, really good at their jobs.
They're no slouches. This ain't some two-bit operation.
I mean, they come up with those impressive sets and those costumes every week, and also all the camera cues and the sound cues. And it's so rare that you see any kind of technical flub on SNL, and it's really amazing the success rate they have. You know?
Yeah. It's something to be applauded.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm glad they're getting some recognition.
Absolutely. And I think that's pretty much all we got. Like, the entire cast is coming back. I don't know. It's going to be a huge cast now. Like, with every... I mean, it was already a big cast, but now this and three more cast members, it's, like, kind of overstuffed a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's just how Lorne Michaels seems to prefer it these days. He likes to have a deep bench of people, so if, you know, somebody's going off to do a movie or a TV show or... you know, leaves the show for whatever reason, he's not caught with his pants down and has to like remake the show from the ground up.
That's very true.
Because I mean, true. Lorne's how old is Lorne now? He's got to be in his 70s somewhere, right?
He's a man of a certain age, yes.
Yeah, he's a man of a certain age. He probably doesn't want to reinvent the show from scratch yet again.
I could see that.
You know, the last time we did that was in the 90s when they brought on Will Ferrell and that bunch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, Lorne Michaels, 75 years old.
Well, there you go. 75 years old. I don't want to remake a 46-year-old TV show when I'm 75. I don't want to do that.
Yeah,
I don't want to do it now. I'm 48.
I barely want to do anything, and I'm in my 40s.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can get my energy up for this podcast, and you know, that's it. That's it for me for the week.
I can barely muster that up. I'm about to pass out in the next few minutes. So, like, you, oof.
Exactly. So maybe we should get to the movie.
One more thing. I just remember we didn't mention that they announced that they're going to have Jim Carrey play Joe Biden.
Yes.
On the first episode, which I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I think I know how you feel about it.
I've said it on the show before. I mean, I feel like the show goes to the stunt casting well too often and too easily these days, especially for anybody who's in politics. So, I mean, it'll be fun to see him. It'll be fun to see what he brings to it, but you know, eventually the novelty's going to wear off after a few weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm in the same camp. I mean, I'm a little bit more forgiving. I mean, I guess this all happened when it started, like when it had Tina Fey come in as Sarah Palin for the stunt casting. But like, and ever since then, like when they saw, like, oh, people really like this. Like, ever since then, they've been kind of doing it more and more. Like, you know, of course, Baldwin, when they had Matt Damon for Kavanaugh, and you know, the list can Woody Harrelson Hiller
and Robert De Niro, and I mean, so many people. I'm forgetting some, I'm sure.
They had James Corden at one time and Paul Rudd that other time.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, so it's just, it's no longer novel, you know? So that's.
Yeah.
Lorne was interviewed by Vulture, and he had a little bit to say about it. They asked him, what made you decide to shift towards having the big political impressions go to celebrity cameos? And Lorne said, I honestly don't think of them as celebrity cameos. I think that's sort of the New York Times approach to thinking about things. Alec Baldwin's probably done the show 25 or 30 times. He's just part of an extended group in the same way that if Tina Fey has something meaningful to say on Update, we'd welcome her. It's the same way as Kamala. You saw what she brought to it. So I don't think of it that way. Beck will be doing Pence because he does it brilliantly. And also, you're talking about candidates who are in their 70s. When you put someone 28 in that makeup, it's just different. Obviously, Woody Harrelson did Biden on the first show last season and did it brilliantly. Jason Sudeikis has done it in the past. Part of it is whoever does it has to basically relocate to New York because of quarantine. So there were a lot of factors involved with that, but I'm thrilled Jim's doing it. So.
I guess, but I don't know.
He's kind of pivoting around the question, you know, of like.
I mean, like that whole thing. Well, yeah, when you have 28-year-olds play 70-some-odd-year-old, and I mean, that felt like a bit of a cop out to me. And like they've had younger people play older politicians forever. They've had, you know, Chevy Chase.
Yeah, I mean, Dana Carvey played Ross Perot, for crying out loud. You know,
yeah, Chevy Chase was like Gerald Ford and Clinton, and like they've done it in the past, and it's been fine.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said before, like I'm okay with it. Like usually, when it's somebody who has a connection to SNL, like Tina Fey or Rudolph or Sudeikis,
right?
But like I guess technically Baldwin is connected to SNL. Like he's just been on it enough so many times.
Oh yeah.
But when they do the things like they have like James Corden come in and you know Paul Rudd come in, when stuff like that happens, I'm like, like you have such a huge cast of people. Yeah. Like one of them should be able to fill these shoes.
Yeah, and they're certainly capable of it, but I kind of resent them not getting the shot, I guess. But like if you cast like say just to pick a name out of a hat, Mikey Day as Biden, that's not going to get you an article on Vulture the next day. So and that's part of the game these days. You want to have that viral moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a bit of a bummer, though.
I mean, I feel like that's the real reason, and Lauren doesn't want to say that because,
like, they want to be trending, so they're like, "Oh, we'll put this person in, and we'll be trending."
You know, then you see the headline on Monday. You won't believe who showed up on Saturday Night Live this weekend.
Ooh, click, like, retweet.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know. I sound really cynical about this, I suppose.
Yeah, I know. We try to steer away from that, people. We're trying to, but like sometimes, sometimes we have our cynical pants on.
I mean, but I look forward to seeing what Jim Carrey is going to bring to it. I just think it's funny. It's like, well, I mean, if Biden wins the election, is Jim Carrey going to stick around for the next however many years Biden is in office? I'm guessing probably not.
I really think, like, maybe if Biden does win, they're probably going to do a thing where they just have a different person play Biden. I mean, they've already had, they had Sudeikis and they had Harrelson. Then Mulaney was it for a minute, and now it's Carrie. So, like, I really just think it's going to be, like, a rotating Biden.
You get to be Biden. You get to be Biden. You get to be Biden.
We're all Biden.
Yeah.
I really think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Well, is that all the news?
That's all the news that's fit to print.
Okay, that's all the news. Should we dive into the movie this week?
Let's dive into the movie this week. This movie was suggested to us, too.
Oh, was it? Who suggested it to us?
Shit, I gotta find it. Sorry.
Okay.
This movie, How to Beat the High Cost of Living, came out July 11th, 1980. Directed by Robert Shearer, mm-hmm. who, from what I see, seems to be more of a TV guy. Like, he's done, like, a lot of directing for he's directed episodes of Dynasty, Fame, Love Boat, Matlock, Star Trek The Next Generation, I found out. He's done, like, mostly...
What's episodes of Next Generation?
I gotta find that, too. Never
mind. I'll look it up. I knew the name was familiar, and that's why.
I did not expect to be talking about this movie today, so I didn't plan anything.
But I mean, the backstory of this movie, I looked it up. It's a little, it's kind of interesting. It was originally written by Robert Kaufman in 1971 to 72. And he was just having trouble selling it for years unless he could get major bankable stars in it. But when he did the movie Love at First Bite, that was successful enough for them to get the green light for How to Beat the High Cost of Living with younger, lesser known names.
Interesting.
And so they got, well, for our purposes, Jane Curtin, who is just off SNL at the time she made this movie.
This is her first movie.
Yeah, it's her film debut. Susan St. James, who a few years later she'd star with on the sitcom Kate and Ally. And Jessica Lange, and this was her third film. She had done King Kong and something else that I don't have in front of me right now. But she was very early in her career.
Yeah, this was like an early film for a lot of folks. Oh, so this film was recommended to us by Steve Harold, a fan of the podcast, at Joint Partners.
All right, thank you very much, Steve. We appreciate it. That was a cool novel suggestion because this movie, it's kind of fallen by the wayside. It's kind of forgotten today, I would say.
I literally had no idea this movie existed until Steve told us.
Like, Darren, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Do you hear me?
Okay, you dropped out for a second in the middle of the word existed. I actually remembered this movie. I'd never seen this movie before, but I remembered the cover art that I guess was the poster art. But I remember, like, you know, back in the days of Blockbuster Video and all that, I would see this on the shelf. And it's kind of a memorable image because it's the three of them and they're wearing a barrel. It's like a caricature painting of them, and they're like, it's implied they're naked under the barrel because, you know, it's that old cartoon symbol of you're so poor you can't even wear clothing, so you can't even afford clothing, so you just wear a barrel with suspenders, and so the three of them are in a barrel together. And I never knew much about this movie. I knew it was about women with money problems, but I assumed from the cover art that it was like they become strippers or prostitutes or something sexual like that, because the cover art is kind of sexual.
Typical man.
It's like a titillating poster. So,
I was going to say that, like, throughout the whole movie, there's like a whole, there's a stream of titillation throughout this entire movie. Just lots of just, like, you know, boobies and, you know, just, yeah, hey sailor, come get it type of vibe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's still got that sort of 70s vibe where, like, movies, popular entertainment movies were still, like, very kind of sexualized, more so than today, I think.
Yeah, very, very much so. This is very sexualized. I mean, I don't know, maybe if because this came because of the success of Animal House or what, but we'll get into it, but there's, like,
I think there was some of it in there. Yeah, that's got to be in the mix. I mean, that was just kind of how you made a comedy. You did some outrageous stuff, you destroyed some property, and you showed some boobs. so you got to check off all those boxes. So it opens. Should we get into it?
Yeah. Let's get into it. I think we also touched on the fact that it takes place in the early 1980, and the intro was very 80s, I felt, because it's like one of those animated intros.
Yeah.
And it has like that kind of smooth jazz music playing in the background with the funky bass.
Oh God, the score in this movie, at like all through the movie, it's like, and it was like this really repetitive score, and it's heavy on the bass, and it's got a lot of synthesizer because it's 1980, so it sounds kind of pornrific, you know?
Very pornrific. It's like, it's kind of like Love American Style, but, you know, just like maybe a notch above that.
Like, in any time something like vaguely amusing happens, you get a big wah, wah, and it gets old fast.
Is that how a bass sounds to you?
Yes. The entire score, it just sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher talking. Just wah, 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 wah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, well, let's introduce our characters in this film.
Yeah. So we got three characters. We start out with Susan St. James's character, and I didn't keep track of most of the character names on this, so
probably I got needed. It.
Okay. Well, she's waking up for her day with her boyfriend, who's played by like a young Fred Willard,
yeah.
who I didn't realize was in this movie, and it's really weird because Fred Willard plays it pretty straight in this movie.
Yeah, he's not like really he's a straight guy. He's not really like funny at
he's
all.
He's playing like a normal dude, and it was really weird to see like a Fred Willard performance that wasn't drenched in like six layers of irony.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. I mean, he was playing this normalish dude of average intelligence, and I was just look at Fred Willard being all normal.
Look at him spreading his wings.
Yeah.
So their character names are Jane and Robert, and then we get a lot of exposition about them, like, immediately.
A lot of exposition.
There's so much exposition. It's bad exposition.
A lot of exposition.
There's, like, most of this dialogue is just straight-up exposition, like Basil exposition.
Yes. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, we've been together for 2 years ever since you got divorced. And, you know, and it's all these characters explaining to each other things they already know.
Yeah. So their characters are Jane and Robert. Jane is recently divorced with two kids. Mm-hmm. Jane has been going out with Robert, you know, her boyfriend. And because they're both super broke, they can't afford to pay a babysitter to watch her kids. So they like kind of make out and sleep in the car in their garage.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't want, you know, her kids to see some random dude in her boudoir.
Yeah. She's got young kids. She doesn't want some rando stepping out of her bedroom. So they sleep in the car. And
yeah.
I guess the kids never question why their mother goes to sleep in the garage every night, but and they've made themselves at home in the backseat of the car. They've got an alarm clock in there and it wakes them up to news about inflation because it's, you know, 1980 and the economy was still really, really bad. And So that's
their situation. They need money. Then we go to Louise, played by Jessica Lange. A woman who's married to this guy Albert, played by Richard Benjamin, the great Richard Benjamin.
Right, he's a very successful vet. But we soon learn Jessica Lange is being audited by the IRS, and she can't write any checks for 2 weeks. She's got an antique shop that's not showing a profit, and so her assets are frozen basically, and she needs like $1,000. And we find out like a little later. When Richard Benjamin is meeting with his accounting people, I guess, and they're like, oh, well, you lent your money to your wife to start this business, but you have to pay all this interest on it because that wasn't a gift, that was a loan, and you're not charging your wife interest, so you owe all this money to the IRS. I think I'm explaining that okay.
Yeah, because I think according to the IRS, it was... they listed it as a hobby and not a business.
Right.
And then Albert was like, no, it's a business. And she said, well, if it's a business, it's not showing a profit and, you know, you're not charging your wife interest on it. So what's the deal here?
Yeah. And then we meet Jane Curtin's character, Elaine. She's like this suburban housewife. She's coming home from her day, and her husband leaves her via an answering machine message for a 19-year-old. And she finds out... What's that?
Just yee. That's
yeah.
Really young.
Yeah. Well, above the age of consent. So in 1980, that's, you know, all systems go.
God.
Woo! You gotta look at this thing through 1980 eyes, I think.
That's true.
If we're gonna look at this through 2020 eyes, we'll be here all day.
Very true.
But her husband has cleaned out her checking and savings account, and it leaves her flat broke, and she's got $1,000 in car payments due on Monday. So they're all in financial trouble of some kind or another. Susan St. James, she's getting like $200 in child support. And her ex is a high school football coach, and he doesn't want to give her any more money. And they go into great, great detail about all their financial troubles and exactly what their financial troubles and amounts of money are bandied around. And it spends about 20 minutes longer on this than it needs to.
Yeah. I mean, if I had any criticism about this movie, that's one of the things. This, like, a lot of the dialogue is just straight up exposition. Just like you said before, where it's like, well, I need this money because blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, don't forget, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know that I can't have this because blah, 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 blah. It's like...
Right, right. And we've been married for 9 years and blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, get to the freaking point. This is all set up, people.
Come on.
Yeah, I was like, get on with it.
Like you said, Elaine is in dire straits. At one point, she's at a bar, kind of drinking her troubles away. She leaves the bar. She runs. She gets in her car, drives off, runs through a stop sign, gets pulled over by the cops. And the cop is this guy, Jack, played by the great Dabney Coleman.
Yeah, Dabney Coleman. And it was a novel to see Fred Willard play a normal guy. It was kind of neat to see Dabney Coleman play a non-jerk. He's nice by Dabney Coleman standards, you know?
Yeah, and it's weird, too, because like this movie came out a couple months before another Dabney Coleman movie where he would be, you know, paired up with three women, 9 to 5. So I was like, oh.
Yeah, and he's a super jerk in that one.
Oh, the biggest.
And like a couple years after this movie, he was in Tootsie with Jessica Lange, and he's like the sexist pig in that one. That was Dabney Coleman's brand. He had a sitcom called Buffalo Bill that was like canceled very quickly, and he played a real jerky guy in that. And I think the theory on that was like audiences weren't ready for such an unsympathetic protagonist. But
right,
I mean, he reportedly was like a very nice guy in real life, but he was just really, really good at playing jerks.
Yeah, it's like, I forget his name, that guy with the red hair that's in Ghostbusters, Walter Peck.
Oh, William Atherton?
Yeah, he was a jerk in that and the Die Hard movies.
Right, right. Yeah, he was the go-to jerk in the 1980s. Yeah. When you needed, like, a corporate jerk, he was your call. If you needed a sexist jerk, Dabney Coleman, that's your guy.
Right. Different types of jerks for different types of work.
Exactly, exactly. But he's only a semi-jerk in this one. Jane Curtin, she tries to talk her way out of getting a ticket, and she asks him out for a cup of coffee, and then he reveals, like, well, I can't do that because I'm married, or we can't go to my house because I'm married.
Yeah.
And then she yells at him, she hits him with her purse, and then he finally lets her go when she threatens to call his wife. She's like, if you arrest me, I'm going to get one phone call, and you know what that phone call is going to be. Kind of clever on her part, especially considering she's half in the bag.
Yeah, but that part of me was like, wait, how do you know her wife's phone number, his wife's phone number? Like,
yeah, well, it was 1980. There were still phone books. So maybe she could have just looked it up. I don't know.
In the white pages, I guess.
I guess the cops would give you access to that. But I mean, if you, I don't know. It's a funny joke. Let's not overanalyze it.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ruin it with, thinking about it.
Yeah. But they're all in dire straits. Jane Curtin tries having a yard sale, selling all her stuff. She's being so chintzy. She's like even charging people 25 cents to pour them coffee, a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And we find out the backstory of the three ladies is they were cheerleaders together, I guess, in high school.
Yeah. They're old friends. They all know each other and they're all flat broke now, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see.
And then also at this point at the garage sale, they meet up with one of their friends, Natalie, who is an actress I remember from this TV show Soap back in the 70s.
Okay. Yeah.
Who was like, let me see if I can find her name. I think
Catherine Damon.
Yes. Catherine Damon. Yeah.
Catherine Damon.
And, she's like the friend that like they kind of make fun of because she's kind of, I guess, out there and kind of wacky. And she's trying to get Jane Curtin's character, Elaine, to help her with the shopping center anniversary show. Because like, there's supposed to be this big deal show happening at the local mall, the Valley River Mall.
Okay. Yeah, her character was rather inconsequential, I thought, so I didn't really take notes on but yeah, that does figure into the plot. And oh, I guess we should say that they try to up the stakes a little more. Louise, Jessica Lange's character, she gets a summon. Her husband, Richard Benjamin, is suing her on the advice of his financial guys. So yeah, so she's like upset. He's doing that so that he doesn't have to pay all this money to the IRS. And they explain this at great length. And then Susan St. James, she is late on her period, and so she's very likely pregnant. And Fred Willard wants her to have an abortion because they can't really afford to have a child.
Yeah, that was wow.
And she's also got her freeloading father moving in. We have Eddie Albert from Green Acres moving in.
That's where he's from. Oh yeah.
His character doesn't really go anywhere. He's just there. He has a couple scenes, and I'm just like, why is this in the movie? Why are we spending time on this? This doesn't up the stakes. This doesn't. You know, okay, yes, you have Eddie Albert in a bedazzled jean jacket, and that's kind of amusing, but...
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, why is he in the bedazzled jean jacket? That's,
I don't know. Was that an everyday thing in 1980? I don't know. I was only, like, 8, so...
It's a choice.
It's a choice. That's a choice.
Yeah. But, yeah, so we find out Jane's dad wants to move in with her because... Jane's mom kicked him out of the house because she now wants to shack up with another woman, and right. They've adopted a black kid.
Oh, did they? I missed that part.
They mentioned that later on in the movie.
Okay. And because again, it was 1980, and just becoming a lesbian or I shouldn't say becoming a lesbian. I should say realizing you're a lesbian. And
yeah, well, walk that back.
Yeah, no, yeah, well, it was 1980, and it was still a choice back then.
God. Oh, wow.
Well, no, that is literally how they looked at it. You know, she's like, oh, well, she decides she likes women now. And it's like, so it's a little cringy there.
No, but, I hear you.
But that's the extent of the joke is what I'm saying. Like, that was, you know, oh, you know, they were married for 36 years, and now... she's with a woman. Wah, wah.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think the dad also had that line. Well, when he talked to the daughter, hey, where can I bunk until this crazy bro decides to go straight again?
Right. Yeah.
I was like, wow.
You just kind of look at this and you shake your head.
Oof. Yeah. Not. Oh boy. Oh boy.
But I mean, so like I said, this movie's really slow. It spends literally like 20 or 30 minutes just establishing these characters have money problems. And it gives them about 3 reasons more why than they need it. I mean, you could just have like one big thing instead of all these other things adding up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were trying to sort of maybe have like each woman kind of represent something that maybe somebody in the audience was going through. It's like, oh, you've had your husband leave you, or you've gone through a divorce, or you haven't, like, they're trying to cover, like, the money problems every American kind of would have, I guess. But, I mean, you don't really need to do that.
Yeah, you don't need your movie to be all things to all people. Just, like, have a few specific things happening, and that's enough. We can just, presumably, we should be able to relate to them just because we're human beings with empathy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, that's not exactly what I'm going through, so I can't relate.
Exactly. So anyway, they hatch this scheme to rob this big money ball in the mall, in the local mall, that's got, and it's this huge glass or plastic sphere that, you know, they have the air jet in there, and that's going to put in, they're going to put in all their profits of the day that they earn at the mall. And then if you guess the right amount of money, you win that money or a portion of that money or something. I don't know.
No, I think you went a trip to Hawaii.
Oh yeah. It was a 2-week all expenses paid trip to Hawaii. So that was their 1-year anniversary promotion for the mall. And so the ladies decide we're going to rob this.
Exactly. Yeah. I think Elaine is the one who has the idea. Cause like they're talking about how can we make money? Elaine jokes, like, oh, maybe we can make porno flicks or prostitutes ourselves.
Right.
Again, another like constant like just going straight for the sex for the ladies, and this one's without. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But they quickly discount that idea because they're like, oh, well, there are like, you know, dozens of college girls just giving away for free. So, you know, we couldn't make money at that.
Dozens.
So they decide, yeah, they're gonna pull off this heist. And they have about a week to plan it, because that's when the money ball thing is going to happen. And so they decide to, they're over the course of the week, they're hatching this scheme, basically. And they're figuring it all out, and they're getting the stuff that they need.
Right. So basically they figure out, well, how can we steal the money without anybody seeing us? I think it was Louise who says, oh, if we go in underneath the ball, that's be the best way to do it. So
right.
Then they reveal that Elaine's husband, who left her, was an architect and he designed them all. So she goes to his office to get the blueprints. And then they find out that there's actually already a tunnel down there that goes from the mall to the nearby river.
Right. And then they're gonna go underneath the money ball. They're gonna suck out the money with a vacuum. So they have to steal a vacuum, and then they're gonna put the money in bags, and then they're gonna make their getaway through that tunnel, and then they're gonna go into the river, and they steal a canoe so that they can make their getaway down this river. And
how do you steal a canoe? First of all,
you go to like a nearby dock and you knock over a bunch of oars, and while the person there is helping you pick up all the oars, your friend steals the canoe and just paddles it down the river. And that is how you steal a canoe, according to this movie.
Foolproof plan.
Yeah. And no one ever comes after them. No one notices a giant canoe out the back of a station wagon.
People walk around with canoes all the time, man. How can you prove they stole it?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, everybody's got a canoe.
Okay.
They also decide to pull off like some small crimes to kind of ramp up to this big crime. So they're stealing the canoe, they're stealing the vacuum to suck the money out of the bubble. There's a scene where Susan St. James goes into one of the local Safeways, and she fills up her grocery cart, and then she pulls a gun on the cashier while the cashier's checking her out. But the cashier's so blasé, she just pulls the gun out of her hand and rings it up.
Which, I mean, I knew you can get a gun anywhere in this country. I didn't know you could literally get it at, like, the local supermarket, had I known.
Well, they say that it wasn't a real gun. It was, like, some gun for her kids. It was, like, a prop gun or something. I don't think it was a real gun that fired bullets. But by this point in the movie, I was, like, playing around on my phone, and so I was only sort of half paying attention.
Wow, very telling.
At this point, I have a note on my phone. I wrote, I think this movie has stopped time. So,
oh, wow. Maybe if you watch the movie in reverse, you can go back in time.
I mean, this movie's really slow, you guys. I mean, I know movies were slower in 1980 because it was before MTV and all that, but it's slow.
It moves at a certain pace.
It moves at a snail's pace.
Oh, boy. It's some kind of something. We should also mention, so Elaine got a job with the anniversary show at the mall through her friend Natalie, and then she figured out where the fuse box is. So I think their plan is to, like, once they get the hose, the vacuum hose underneath the globe, she's going to turn off the power at the fuse box, and then that'll buy them some time and cause some confusion while they steal the money, put it in plastic bags, and a canoe off in it.
Right. Foolproof plan, really.
Foolproof plan.
Yeah. Not a damn thing can go wrong with this one.
Not at all. I don't see how it could go wrong. That's, oh boy.
Let's see. Next I have, amidst all this planning, we've also got their romantic complications. Elaine is starting like this sort of flirtatious relationship with Jack the Cop. So we get to see Jane Curtin and Dabney Coleman make goo-goo eyes at each other.
Right, because the cop comes, because when they go to steal the vacuum and the tubes from Jane's boyfriend's hardware store, so I guess they're just ripping off her boyfriend, Like,
you can only rob your boyfriend when you're planning a heist. Your boyfriend or your ex-husband. I mean, that's like in the rule book.
That's who else are you going to rob? You rob the ones you love.
I mean, what are you going to do? Rob a person you don't know?
That's just weird, man.
No, yeah.
That's weird.
You want that personal touch.
Right. So then they go to rob her boyfriend's store. They bring her kids with them because she can't afford a sitter. And, of course, the kids go off and do some horseplay that causes her to be like, hey, stop that horseplay. And, of course, they trip the alarm. They freak out, and it causes the cops to come. Of course, it's only one cop, and it's, of course, Jack, the cop.
Yeah. He is apparently the only cop in town. I think he is the only cop we see in the entire movie.
He legit is. This takes place in Eugene, Oregon, and I don't know what the crime rate up there in Eugene, Oregon is like, but I gotta imagine it's pretty minimal if only one cop is needed to cover the entire city.
Yeah, yeah. It's like how we had just that one cop in Bridesmaids. And it was played by the guy from the IT Crowd. And, you know, see, he's the only cop we see in the whole movie. It's just, you know, it's a movie world where there's just one cop per town.
Just one cop just working an entire beat.
That's right. That's right. I mean, he's got to handle that homicide downtown, but he's also got to do a traffic stop later in the day. It's just one cop covering it all.
He has to handle domestic violence and jaywalking.
Exactly. He has range as a cop, is what we're saying. We also find out that Richard Benjamin's character, the Arthur the vet, he's hooking up with his nurse, who's played by Sybil Danning, who was a big staple of like 1980s movies.
Sybil Danning, I don't think I'm familiar.
Yeah, she did all sorts of sort of B movies, and she was she was one of those B movie actresses who, I guess I should just say, she got topless a lot. You know, that was kind of her thing. That was her. She was a big voluptuous woman. I think she did a Elsa of the SS movie. I think that was like one of hers. And she did like a lot of horror and sci-fi movies. Like that was another video cover I would see. I don't know if I've ever seen a Sybil Danning movie, but I saw enough of the video covers to know who she was and what she was about.
Yeah. Let me see. She was in the Halloween remake, Amazon Women on the Moon. Oh shit.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow. All right.
It's an inconsequential appearance because she's just like there at like their inspiration point, and she's making out in the car with Richard Benjamin. But I just thought I'd note it because she's a somewhat notable name.
Naughty and, Nymphs? Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't fall down the Sybil Danning rabbit hole.
I'm climbing out right now.
You won't come out for a while. but like all the characters are at inspiration point at the same time. Pretty much, except for Susan St. James.
No, she's there too.
Oh, she is there too. Okay. There's so many characters to keep track of.
Yeah.
Jane Curtin's up there. She's making out with Dabney Coleman in their car, and she gets her foot stuck in her glove compartment or his glove compartment, who's ever
driving. Yeah. Because after Jack shows up at the hardware store ready to arrest him, they're able to talk their way out of it.
Yeah.
And you know, use the womanly charms. And so then they all are able to go home, and then Jane Curtin goes home, and the cop is there waiting for her, saying, oh, hey, my wife left me, so you want to, like, hook up?
You want to fool around? And she's like, no, the neighbors will think it's weird that there's a cop car outside my place for the entire night, so let's go to Inspiration Point.
Right. So,
yeah, like their old high school makeout spot.
Right. Right.
And, so,
said, like then they make out. She gets her foot caught in the glove box. Albert, Louise's husband, is there with her. You know, the secretary with the nurse.
Yeah.
And then Jane is there with Robert, and they're like, you know, doing the deed.
Yeah.
And then they all kind of meet up, and awkward situations abound.
Yeah. Here's another note I had at this point in the movie. I wrote, this movie alternates between scenes that are too long and scenes that have no point. So,
you know what?
I'll get the movie by this point.
I'll give that to you. Yeah, this scene really didn't. It really didn't make a matter.
Like, this is ostensibly a heist movie. And, like, you know, you got a formula for a heist movie. You find out, you plan out the heist. You're like, oh, this is the thing we're going to go get. This is how we're going to get it. And let's do all the preparation and the planning. And so by the time the actual heist rolls around, you, the audience, are very familiar with the plan. So you know how it's supposed to go. And then they introduce all sorts of complications. And then you get to see them deal with all those complications along the way. And here they just kind of meander. You know, like, sometimes they're planning the heist, sometimes they're concerned about their love lives, and
yeah, it's just weird. I hate to say it, but I think because it was like three female leads, I think maybe maybe the writer of the movie was like, oh no, we need to include more guys in this and show their love lives, or else people won't get it, or I don't know. Like, I understand what you mean. Yeah.
None of it felt necessary. None of the romantic stuff felt necessary to me. I mean, because, like, the fact that Dabney Coleman's a cop, it doesn't really add any suspense to the movie, because he's never even close to catching them.
Yeah, like, it would have been one thing if they had them hook up and then he be, like, suspicious of her and this heist they're about to pull up. So there's, like, conflict there, where it's like, oh, do I take, you know, do I go with this guy I just met who I like, or do I just go ahead with the heist and risk being caught by him, like,
because he is the one cop in town,
because he is the law. Exactly.
He is the law. He is literally the law. He is the only person. I don't think he just goes back to an empty station house and and he's just the one cop. He checks the car into himself because he's also working the motor pool, and
yeah, he's it. He's I mean, I don't know what cops do in police houses.
Yeah.
Offices. What's it called to get station? There it is.
Station house. Yeah.
Station house. There you go. Police offices. That's not a word.
Yeah. And he gets there, the paperwork stacked up because he's also the desk sergeant. And so nobody's been working on that when he's been out patrolling and flirting with Jane Curtin. So
that's right. Paperwork's piling up.
It's amazing that we see him at all with all the things he has to do being the one cop in town.
He needs an assistant. He's a busy man.
Yeah. Yeah. But, like, finally, We get to the day of the heist, which has been, according to the movie, a week. According to my experience watching the movie, it was about 36 years.
Wow. You're like fucking Taron Killam's character.
This was a Jebediah Atkinson. This brought out the Jebediah Atkinson in me.
Right, fair enough.
So of course, you know, day of the heist, we got the complications, and Elaine wakes up to discover that her power has been cut off because she hasn't paid her bill, and she can't get her car out of the garage. So that's, you know, big monkey wrench in the plan. So she calls the power company.
Right, and we have a cameo by the great Garrett Morris, who plays the power guy, who apparently is the lone black man in all of Eugene, Oregon.
That sounds about right.
Like, he's literally it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but then we get, like, a little funny scene between the two SNL alum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's cute. It's just them talking over the phone, and she's trying to convince him to turn her power back on, because I think she says, like, she's got a man in an iron lung, and it's a, you know, she's just making stuff up on the fly. And he's like, well, that's, you know, hey, that's the best made up story I've ever heard.
Right. And then he said, oh, well, don't worry, because, like, the Safeway is open 24 hours. And she's like, well, what good does that do? He's like, well, you can buy candles there whenever you want. Ah, ha, ha. What's up, girl?
And then he hangs up and boom. And that's Garrett Morris. That's all we get of Garrett Morris in the movie. Just like on SNL, he was severely underused in this movie.
Touche. Absolutely. And so it appeared, like, the day of the heist, Elaine is going to be late. She just ends up, like, just driving through the garage door, just bursting through it. Mm-hmm. Louise is late because she gets into an argument with her husband about the lawsuit. Right. And Jane gets late because she gets a flat tire and she has a canoe and she can't get to the river. So she ends up just walking down to the river with a canoe on her head.
Yeah.
So everybody's late already. The plan has already just gone to pot.
Yeah, they're running about an hour behind their plan. And when they get to the mall, Dabney Coleman had a little scene opposite Jessica Lange, which I thought was I thought that was amusing just because they played boyfriend and girlfriend in Tootsie. And so I'm just watching them and I'm just like, ah, I remember them in Tootsie. I wish I was watching Tootsie right now.
I remember them in a much better movie.
Yes, yes. So, you know, that I like that scene just because it reminded me of a better movie.
Oh, scathing.
And Jane Curtin, she's like taking part in the little community theater show thing happening in the mall. And that's like their big distraction thing, right?
Yeah, that's the way they're going to distract them. Because like she was going to, I mean, she took the job at the pageant just so she would have access to the power box, the fuse box, so she could flip it down, flip off the power box, and right. Shut off the lights everywhere. So I wish
this movie went into as much detail about the heist planning as it did about the financial troubles that motivated the heist planning.
Yeah, they really just kind of, I mean, their plan, it just, I mean, we're getting there, but they're just, so many flaws in this plan.
Like, I mean, you enjoy a heist movie so much more when you have the plan like all set in your head and you know it as well as the characters because you know how things are supposed to go and then you can enjoy them going wrong. And here they just kind of they throw so much other stuff at you, it doesn't really stick, you know?
Yeah, it's more of a heist idea than a heist plan.
Yeah, it's a heist short story. a heist haiku, if you will.
You beat me to it. Heist haiku.
They wrote out their heist plan in a 5-7-5 scheme. So,
drill hole in globe, vacuum out
cash,
canoe away. Profit? I don't know.
Yeah. There you go. Heist haiku.
Heist coup.
A heist coup. So are there any complications we've forgotten? Like Jane Curtin, she tries to turn off the power, but it doesn't turn off the power to the entire mall like they expect.
Yeah, like at this point, Jane, Susan St. James' character, she canoes to where the tunnel entrance is. She meets up with Louise. Has already kind of cut a hole and drilled in the ceiling and drilled a hole in the globe,
which nobody notices. Nobody hears. Nobody notices. And it's like this big hole in the ceiling.
I mean, I think maybe it seemed like it was kind of loud in there. So maybe.
Yeah, I mean, they've got the Moneyball fan working, and it's throwing the money all around, and there's a cheering crowd. But how does nobody notice that? And then she makes, like, this really dinky hole in the globe to suck the money out. It's like maybe a 6-inch diameter circle.
Yeah, you don't need a big hole to get money out. Just something yay big, I guess.
I guess you don't want a lot of spillage with the money, but
yeah, exactly.
It seemed like an awfully snug hole, and they put this industrial strength vacuum cleaner up through the hole to suck out all the money, and then it goes into the garbage bags, and they do that. And at some point, Jean Curtin, she's supposed to cut the power.
Right, she cuts the power, but I guess she finds out that the power doesn't cut out to the entire mall like she thought. It just cuts off the stage lights, which is something you really should have known.
Yeah. Before doing this. You maybe want to research that just a tad and just not assume stuff.
But John, then you wouldn't have time to go out with your cop boyfriend.
This is true. You know, you can't get that 5-7-5 rhyming scheme right for your heist haiku. So.
That's right. Heist coup.
Your heist coup.
So then she realizes that it's only the power on the stage that turns off. Then the guards are getting suspicious about what's going on with the ball, because I think at this point Louise sees a rat downstairs and she screams.
Oh, yes, she screams, and then people are like, "What's that?" And
yeah. So then that's when Louise is like, "Oh snap, the jig is almost up." So she like tries to distract everybody by like getting out on stage. It's like, "Hey everybody, look over here. And then she talks about how, "Oh wow, we're all broke. We all have money problems, right? Like, right. You know,
this is Elaine on stage, not Louise. I think you said Louise.
Oh, sorry. I meant, yeah, this is Elaine.
Jane Curtin.
Curtin, yes. And then she's like, wow, we're all really struggling. Like, soon enough, like, we'll, you know, all we have is the clothes on our backs, and soon that'll be gone, right? Like, yeah. here's 1981, and she takes off her jacket. And then here's 1982, and she takes off her shoes and blouse. Right. And then, of course, all the guys are like, yeah. And, you know, that gets all the men folk all hot and bothered. And
yeah, they start whooping it up because, you know, yeah, pretty lady taking her clothes off. And yeah. Even the guards are all distracted. They're all just, yeah. They aren't doing anything to stop it. None of them are like, hey, maybe we should pull this stripping woman off stage. Maybe that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
Nobody says that. They're all just like, oh, boobs.
Yeah. No one's like, hey, there are kids here. Maybe we shouldn't.
Exactly. This is a public spot. Maybe this woman shouldn't be taking her clothes off at 4 p.m. or whatever time it is. I think it's during the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think at this point it's kind of nighttime.
It was dusk.
Yeah, because it was weird. Because when Jane was canoeing to the tunnel, the sun was out. But then when she got to the tunnel, it was kind of dark. So I was like, I'm not sure exactly. Yeah. But whatever. But
yeah. So, it's one of those movies where the sun sets just between scenes because it's too tough to in movies it's just day or night. There's never a transition.
That's right. Either or. There's no in between.
You get a nice shot of the sunset, and then suddenly it's like midnight.
Absolutely. Movie magic, people.
Yeah, yeah. So Jane Curtin, she's stripping to distract the crowd. Everybody's whooping it up. Meanwhile, Susan St. James and Jessica Lange, they're tying up the money. They get these two big garbage bags full of money.
Right. So then so they're getting away with it, and then at this point, Elaine, like, you know, takes off her shirt, takes off her top, takes off her bra. You see boobies. And then this thing happened, which I forget happens in like the early 80s movies where like a woman would just, you know, get naked and all the guys would just be so horned up to just like cause destruction or something like that. Remember those?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also got like a very early 80s thing where it's like this super obvious body double. Because, like, you know, when she takes off her top, it is just a close-up of breasts. And then later they cut to Jane Curtin, and it's just a shot of her from, like, the shoulders up. So it's like...
Right. And everybody's like, ga-ga-ga, going!
Yeah, yeah.
Awooga! Like, so...
Yeah. Yeah. There was a bit, like, when... Yeah, like, one of the guards, like, he climbs a scaffolding to get a better look, right?
Yeah, well, no, what happens is, I think at this point, Natalie, Elaine's friend, climbs the scaffolding to put the spotlight on her, because it seems like it's working, whatever Elaine is doing. Well, not whatever, she's taking off her clothes. So as she's up on the scaffolding, adjusting the light so people can get a better look at her, like, as she takes her top off, all the guards go, you know, go gaga, and then there's a guard in a little motor cart, like a security golf cart, and the sight of her boobs causes him to like steer the cart into the scaffolding that Natalie's on, which causes Natalie to crash into the plastic globe, spreading the money in the globe everywhere. So the Powerball breaks and money goes flying everywhere. Then everyone goes bananas, scraping and trying to grab the money.
Right, because they're already hyped up because they saw the body double's boobs,
right.
And now they're hyped up because there's just free money everywhere. So everybody scrambles, and I did like when the crowd is like scattering around, and then Jane Curtin is just standing there on stage, and she's like still topless apparently, and they just have this old man who's just sitting there, who's just grinning at topless Jane Curtin.
Yeah, he's just .
that was a cute moment. Like the two gags I really liked were the gun in the checkout line at the Safeway and the old man just sitting there grinning at topless Jane Curtin.
Just like, yeah.
He's just like, hey, what's going on? I mean, he doesn't say anything, but he's just got that lecherous expression on his face.
Yeah. So then what happens after that is Louise and Jane make off with the two trash bags full of money. They put it in the canoe They put all their equipment in the canoe.
The vacuum and yeah, and like I presumably the saw that she used to saw through the floor or ceiling.
Yeah. Thing. It's like a heavy vacuum. It's like a shop vac.
Yeah. Yeah. It, you know, it's like a wet dry vac or something that you would use.
Yeah. And then like Louise and her get in the canoe and they push away and they're like, oh, we did it. But it seemed like the canoe, like all that weight was too heavy. So the canoe ended up kind of tipping over.
Well, no, Louise stands up in the canoe because the seat is wet.
Oh,
and then Susan St. James is like, no, don't you never stand up in a canoe. And of course the canoe immediately turns over because it's now unbalanced. And then Louise can't swim. A fact which was never mentioned in the week-long planning of this heist. And you'd think when your heist crew says you get away in a canoe, maybe you should mention, oh, hey, I can't swim. That might be a bad idea. Maybe I shouldn't be the canoe person.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be in the stage show and where I pull the power and end up having to take my top off. To distract. Maybe that should be my job instead of canoe person.
Or maybe just steal a life preserver, like a little, like a vest. Just have that.
Yes. Yes. Or that. So you don't immediately go to drowning.
Again, not very well thought out.
This is what happens when you only have 17 syllables to plan your heist. So
some syllables are going to go by the wayside.
Exactly, exactly. And the life preserver was one of those syllables. That's like 16 syllables right there.
I mean, yeah, you can't fit that.
No. So the money bags, like, they start to float away down the river. And Susan St. James is like, well, do I save Jessica Lange from drowning or do I go after the money? And she, like a chump, decides, oh, well, I'm going to save Jessica Lange from drowning. Because... You know, if I don't, Tootsie doesn't happen, so
that's right.
You know, now I gotta save her.
That's the darkest timeline.
That is the darkest timeline with no Tootsie. Go see Tootsie is what I'm saying.
We could do Tootsie. I mean, Bill Murray is in that.
We should do Tootsie. We should do Tootsie. Yeah, let's pencil that in.
All right, here we go.
That is one nutty hospital.
nice.
So then we cut to the next morning, I guess, because it's daylight again. So
yeah.
They were out there all night rescuing Jessica Lange from drowning, and Jane Curtin, she finds them. She like pulls up on the side of the road and finds them in the river, and she's like, I've been looking for you for hours. And Jane Curtin's like wrapped in a shower curtain, I guess.
Yeah, that made me think, like, why didn't you just put on her regular clothes? I mean, weren't they right there?
I'm assuming the people rioting because of the boobies and the money, they took her clothes, or she couldn't get them back in all the chaos for some reason, so she just had to scrounge something from the mall. They never say. She is just in a shower curtain thing with no explanation.
Yeah, I was like, just put your regular clothes on. Why are you doing this?
Even if you can't get your bra back, presumably you get your blouse back, or you had a coat or something. I don't know. But, you know, I guess it's funnier to see her in the shower curtain. So, yeah. And she's like, oh, you know, where have you two been? I had to flash half the town to distract. What the heck were you two doing? And they're like, I had to save her from drowning and we lost all the money. And then they see like one of the money bags floating just downriver a little bit, and they go after that.
Yeah, it turns out the money bags were actually got caught up in some branches. So it turns out they made out with the money after all. And the heist was a success.
And they get away with it because everybody assumes that the globe being busted open was all that happened. So they don't. Apparently, they found no evidence of the crime. They didn't find the hole in the busted money globe. They didn't find the giant chunk of the floor ceiling that was taken out.
You'd think the one cop in town would have been able to find that, but I guess not.
He's got stars in his eyes for Jane Curtin. He's too distracted. We see at home, we've seen Jane Curtin at home. She's counting up all the cash. She's got like a few thousand dollars. And Jane Curtin, she also got like $21 of tips for her impromptu strip show.
Oh.
But then she's like, I only got $21. Because at that point she thinks they've lost all the money. And then Susan St. James is like, no, you got seven because we agreed to split everything three ways. Yeah.
Three ways. We agreed.
That was cute. That was cute. I liked that little increase in her humiliation. That was funny. So Jane Curtin the next morning at her place, or maybe later that day, I don't know. She's wearing clothing, so you make the call. So she's like, all the money's dried out and she's counted it all out. And then her doorbell rings and it's Jack the cop, Dabney Coleman there. And he doesn't really profess his love to her so much as be like, hey, I want to hook up with you.
Yeah, but then she turns him away saying like, hey, if you just want to hook up, I ain't looking for that. I'm looking for a real mate kind of thing. Yeah. So she just gives him her number and saying, if you want to like go out for dinner or something like that and maybe right. start a relationship, I'll be down for that.
And it's so 1980 because she doesn't give an area code. It's just like, oh, here's my 7-digit phone number. Yeah. And it wasn't a 555 number either.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's like a real number. Hey, now.
I was like, that's a legit phone number there. She just gave legit digits.
Wow. I was like, I wonder whose number that was, actually.
I don't know. I mean, I don't see this movie being successful enough to really cause a problem with the people who have that number. You know, it wasn't any like Jenny 8675309, you know?
Right. I hear you. Jenny.
Who do I turn to?
Oh, great tune.
Great pop song. Great pop song. Who was that? Was it Tommy Tune? Tommy Two Tone? Something like that?
Tommy yes. Something. Tommy Two Tone.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm going to listen to Jenny when we're done recording this. We're almost done. We're so close to the end. And so Jane Curtin, she gives her number to Jack the cop. They go out for Chinese food, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. She gives him the number and she's like, you have a phone in your squad car and you can call me anytime. Because, you know, why should the one cop in town do any police duties when he could just be hitting with Jane Curtin?
Don't go to that homicide. Meet up with me for dumplings.
Exactly.
You want this mushu pork or not?
And then Jessica Lange reconciles with her husband, Richard Benjamin, and I'm like, well, who wants to see that? Because he's been a jerk for the whole movie.
Yeah, like, Richard Benjamin, throughout this whole movie, he plays like a super, like, horny dude. Like, he's constantly...
Yeah.
Like he's constantly ready to plow in his wall. I mean, it's... Nice, I guess, but it's the way he plays it's like all he's interested in is banging his hot wife. Well,
the scene that starts out with where Jessica Lange finds out that her husband is suing her for not paying him enough money for her antique shop, for not paying interest or taxes or something. He's like trying to like get something started with her. He's like all horned up and he knows he's suing her at this point. He just wants to get her into bed before that. And it's super creepy. And we later find out he's cheating on her. And I'm like, at the end, I'm like, well, who wants to see her get back together with this guy? You want to see her dump him and you want to see him get his just desserts, right?
Yeah. I mean, he says he didn't do anything with her, but still, I'm like, you were still at makeout point with your secretary. That ain't nurse. Cool, man. Or wife, or nurse rather.
Nurse. Yeah.
I'm like, dude, he's not really likable in this movie at all.
He is not. I mean, and, you know, him playing jerks, that was definitely in his wheelhouse. But I don't understand why you want to see one of your leads get back together with the jerky spouse at the end of the movie. Like, yeah. Why is that a happy ending?
I mean, I guess because in the end of the movie, like, he convinces the IRS that her business is a business and not a hobby. So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess he helped her out in that respect, but still he's kind of
doesn't really redeem him. Like, he's just fixing the problem he caused, you know.
But he fixed it. He, number one husband.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I mean, it's like, and I'm like, dude, you're 1980 Jessica Lange. You've got options.
Yeah. Oh, so many.
I am pretty sure that 1980 Jessica Lange can do better than Richard Benjamin.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's Eugene Oregon, but like, you gotta, come on.
I mean, Jessica Lange in 1980 Eugene Oregon? Yeah, come on. Tell me she's not running that town in 2 weeks.
she got her pick of the litter.
Exactly. I mean, you were with Sam Shepard, for crying out loud. You could do better than Richard Benjamin, is all I'm saying, Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
And Susan St. James marries Fred Willard, and they can now like sleep together under the same roof. And I guess it's her house, or are they in a new house? I'm not sure.
I think it's the same house, but she was able to get her dad apartment, a condo at a senior complex, and
right.
Now and then the dad now works for Fred Willard's character at the hardware store.
Hmm. So. Okay, I missed that. I'm surprised they didn't put in a line about like, oh yeah, my wife isn't gay anymore. Because I mean, after the Jessica Lange thing, let's put in another stupid twisted thing in there to make it a 1980 happy ending.
Like, oh yeah, that was just a phase she was going through.
Yeah. I don't know. This movie. I think I'm gonna have to go full Zoidberg on this.
Go for, yeah. It's
that was bad and you should feel bad.
Very, very nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't I'm see if I can be more diplomatic, but it's
okay. Yeah.
It's
I'll be bad, I mean, cop.
Yeah.
I'll be, I mean, cop, you be good cop, and then we will have twice the cops of Eugene Oregon.
Double the cups. This movie wasn't great. I feel like maybe it was trying to be a little bit more kind of, I mean, by having three female leads in it, maybe they're trying to be more kind of woman, you know, strong women power type of vibe. Right. But it didn't go, like, they were too afraid to go all in on that. So, like, that's why they kind of pulled it back a little with the sexuality and, you know, showing boobs.
That was fine. I don't have any problem with you know, building a movie around three female leads. I think that's great. It just, like I said, it's just a really slow meandering movie, and it just seems to get to forever to get to the point. And yeah, it just, I mean, I'd love to see, like, I think it would be interesting to see this movie remade and you give it a better treatment, you know.
It kind of reminds me of that that TV show, Good Girls. That
Yeah. I've seen a few episodes of that, and it's a similar premise. Like, three suburban women, they start up a life of crime because they're in dire straits, and not the band Dire Straits, I should clarify. Oh. They're not, like, recording money for nothing.
it's kind of, I kind of feel like that TV show was based on this movie.
I don't know. I mean, you can have a similar premise without it being directly inspired, but
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's a better treatment of the same idea from what I've seen at Good Girls.
Yeah, I hear you. And also, the
women on that show, they have a lot more contrasts among them. I mean, the three women in this movie, they never really have any sort of, they don't have a particularly interesting dynamic among the three of them, you know? Like, they don't, it's not like, oh, these two really disagree or these two don't get along personally, but they have to come together for the heist. There's none of that.
Yeah, I did notice that too. It seemed like Jane Curtin's character was like a little bit more of the wisecracking one. Mm-hmm. And like Jessica Lange was a lot more smarter in this movie than, like, I guess people would think of her, but she was like kind of the brains behind the operation because she was the one like kind of making the plans a little bit. And then Jane, the student St. James character, kind of really didn't have that much in the way of, I guess she was like the goofy one. I don't know. She really didn't have that. Yeah, like, as far as personalities go, there weren't too much to differentiate one from the other.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of bland.
And
you have some talented, funny people in this. You give them something more interesting to play. I mean, my problems with this movie are mostly with the script, you know?
No, fair enough.
So, I mean, I think you had the ingredients. I think you had a good premise, and it's like tying it in with like the financial difficulties that were topical at the time. That's a good idea. That could speak to people. And I mean, if you do that right, it can hit a nerve. Like 9 to 5, that really hit a nerve because that hit on like women in the workplace and the women's lib movement and all that.
Yeah, it seems like 9 to 5 was a better written, better executed version of this movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that 9 to 5 is like what this movie should have been, because I remember that being a pretty interesting movie. And, you know, actually, I mentioned early on this this movie, it was, the script was first written in 1971, and it took nearly a decade to get shot. And according to IMDb, actresses approached for the leading roles over the years included Anne Margaret, Shirley MacLaine, Glenda Jackson, Faye Dunaway, Raquel Welch, Jane Fonda, Dolly Parton, Diane Keaton, Margot Kidder, Mary Tyler Moore, Julie Andrews, Diane Cannon, Sally Field, Goldie Hawn, Madeline Kahn, Terry Garr, Jill Clayburgh, and Ellie McGraw.
Damn. Fucking murderers, right?
I say, like, get all those women together in one film and just do a whole Ocean's 11 style thing, man.
Oh, I'm with that. I could
throw them all together. Throw them all together. Let's have an all-star, all-women heist thing.
Yeah, I mean, we did have Ocean's 8, but that was kind of...
Yeah, I never saw Ocean's 8. I heard it was okay, but not much more than that.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It was like, okay, that was a movie. All right.
Couple other interesting things from the IMDb trivia section. The Valley River Center, where the film's mall scenes are set, is indeed a thriving part of Eugene, Oregon culture. However, the story is set during the commemoration of the first anniversary of the Valley River Center. In actuality, though, the Valley River Center had already been open for 10 years as of the filming of this movie. But they apparently picked the location because it was, they needed an indoor shopping mall, which was next to a river. So
right,
they went with Eugene, Oregon. And this is probably the most amusing thing. Is while filming an outdoor scene in Eugene, a man drove by and yelled, "Jane, you ignorant slut," to Jane Curtin.
I'm sure Jane got a kick out of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because that was one of the recurring lines on Update when she did the point counterpoint with Dan Aykroyd. And Jane, you ignorant slut.
Right. The guy was referencing SNL. He wasn't just calling a woman an ignorant
But. No, he was not. Presumably.
Presumably.
But it was 1980, and again, that was considered totally okay.
It's fantastic. It's like when people walked up to Chappelle and said, "I'm Rick James, bitch."
Yeah, exactly. It's just that's just what you did.
Okay. All right, and that's the movie. That's our movie for today, guys. This movie is streaming for free on Amazon Prime if you have it. It's a movie.
If you have it, go check out Tootsie. Go check out Tootsie. Or just listen to this podcast. We are still under the runtime of this movie, and not to toot our own horns too much, I think we were more entertaining.
Damn straight.
Yeah.
I will toot our own horn.
Yeah, there you go. So take that, 40-year-old movie that we didn't like too much.
Ha! Zinger! We showed you.
You know what? Let me just mention one more thing before we move on to listener feedback and stuff. I just realized we've got another SNL connection to this movie because Susan St. James was married to Dick Ebersol.
Oh, shit! I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. She was, and I know she hosted the show once during the Ebersol years. So.
Far out. I was not aware of that.
I would have kicked myself if I didn't mention that. So, well,
thank you, sir, for mentioning that.
Yeah. Now what we get on the Twitter?
Well, what we got on the Twitter, the guy that recommended this movie to us, Steve Harrell, said, I remember seeing this in theaters when it came out. Always thought it was a bigger hit, but apparently it wasn't. Of course, the obvious thing is Curtin and St. James teaming up after this for Kate and Allie.
Yeah.
That was a big thing. I think this movie... I think it cost like $4 million to make, and it made about $7 million. So it was like a modest hit, but it has kind of gotten forgotten throughout the years.
It has a 43% score on Rotten Tomatoes. That is based on 25 user ratings. And
oh boy,
yeah.
Well, also our fan of the fan and friend of the podcast, Ruby the Rube, said Jane was such an underrated SNL cast member. She kind of had "I'm surrounded by idiots" vibe to her performances that I always thought was fun.
Yeah, yeah, I like her when I see her on the show, because I think she was like a little bit older than most of the rest of the cast. Like, she was in her 30s when most of them were in their 20s.
She was also married too.
She was also married, and I know in the Live from New York oral history book, she tells a story about like when Chevy Chase came back to host the show, and he was like, you know, I really want to do Update, and like he and Lorne called Jane into Lorne's office for a meeting, and Lorne was like, well, Chevy would really like to do Update, and Jane Curtin was like, okay, fine, because she had like tickets to the ballet that night, and she didn't really want to have this conversation, and they were expecting a fight, and they kind of kept presenting their arguments, and she was like, yeah, okay, fine, and she was just wanted to go to the ballet.
I just want to go to the ballet.
And okay. Yeah, I don't, you know, Jane Curtin, I have trouble picturing her like partying with the rest of the cast back in the day, you know?
Yeah, she kind of had that, like Ruby said, that kind of I'm surrounded by idiots vibe. Maybe yeah. Almost kind of like Nora Dunn had the same type of vibe too in her day. Yeah. Or if I may use another analogy, Sam the Eagle from The Muppet Show.
You are all weirdos. Yes.
Because you get that vibe, like you said, because she was older and she didn't party like that. She was just, I don't want to say standoffish.
I think she just had like a more domestic kind of life. She would like do her job at the show, and then she would go home to her husband, where, you know, Aykroyd and Belushi and that gang were up doing lines.
Reading lines for the next show, right?
That's what you meant. Exactly. You have to memorize your lines because you can't just depend on those cue cards.
That's right.
Yeah. So they would call that doing lines in the biz, and they would be on these long white cards.
Yeah, you got to snort those lines right up into your mind.
Snort them up and get them deep into your head. And the fastest path to the brain is through the nasal passages.
That's right. That's just science.
I mean, I understand they would sometimes even go out and like pay people on the street to help them learn their lines.
Wow. Yeah. They'd pay them on the lines. And I imagine they would read their lines off a lot of glass tables too, because that helps.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you see the line, your lines of dialogue reflected back at you, it helps you learn them all the faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just put them on a mirror or sometimes an album cover or, and you just snort those lines up.
Oh, man, right into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's and that's how SNL is made.
Exactly, exactly. So.
Oh, good times, John, good times.
Good times. And the show's coming back.
Yeah, October 3rd, that's my word.
It's right around the corner. We don't know who's hosting yet.
We don't know host, we don't know musical guest, but we know we're getting the entire cast, and we're getting three new cast members. Mm-hmm. We're getting a limited audience. I'm really fascinated to see how this is going to be, how they're going to pull this off.
Yeah, yeah. It's we'll see what Jim Carrey brings to the party as Joe Biden. I'm sure he's going to be funny. I'm sure he's going to do something cool. In my heart of hearts, I do wish it was like a cast member getting a nice breakout thing, like Kate McKinnon as Hillary Clinton, but. What you gonna do? Lauren wants the stars.
That's right. That's what Lauren wants, Lauren gets.
That's right.
Thunder, thunder, lightning, lightning, echo,
thunder,
voice, echo,
thunder,
voice.
Lightning, thunder, yeah. Yeah. So Lauren's like the Wizard of Oz, basically.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. The great Lauren has spoken.
Yeah. Yeah. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. No.
And that's our show, guys. Thanks for listening. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at SNL Nerds Show. Mm-hmm. Listen to the podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, all your whatchamabouts and zippity doodahs.
Or the place you just listen to it on. That works.
Oh, yeah, that too.
You're listening to this now. So keep doing that.
Yeah.
And please tell a friend. Tell a friend, rate and review. It really does help the podcast out. We want to spread word of mouth on this thing.
Trying to make this thing grow. Mm-hmm. And as always, you can follow me on Twitter at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N Credible.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Trumbull Comic, T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L, and the word comic.
All right.
And that's our show for this week. I think we're going to hold off on announcing what we're going to do next week because we still got some things up in the air. We're still working some angles.
It's going to be a secret.
It's going to yeah, we'll announce that on the Twitter page. That's another reason to go follow us on the Twitter at SNL Nerd Show. So, anything else?
No, I got nothing.
Okay, so we're just gonna meander and sputter out, kind of like this movie.
I'm gonna think about what to have for dinner.
I'm gonna start stripping to distract people.
Oh Jesus!
Yeah.
Don't.
No, it's okay. There's no cameras, so it's all cool.
Oh. Da 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 da.
And I've got a body double. I'm just gonna edit in somebody else's body parts. So,
it's like a black guy.
Yeah. Why have continuity?
They zoom in, it's like Lexington Steel or something like that. It's like what?
No. I'm just gonna edit in shots of Terry Crews.
So. Oh, well done. Well done.
So I guess that's our show. But so we'll see you next week. And until then. Nerds out!
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.